Well, as we turn back to the book of Judges in chapter 16, as we get to this part in the portion where we see something of the tragedy of Yahweh's servant, you will notice within the passage there's lots of contrasts and parallels. We've always got to be doing that when we're studying the Bible. Are there themes and particularly words that are repeated again and again? And you'll see parallels and contrasts. And so very often the parallels and the contrast is really what the writer wants us to see. Samson calls on the Lord, doesn't he? After the slaughter of the Philistines in chapter 15. But he calls on the Lord, doesn't he? Before the slaughter of the Philistines in chapter 16. His pleading and his calling upon the Lord, though, stand at the center and the climax of each of the narratives. The writer of the book of Judges wants us to see that Samson is a man, although with many, many faults, as we shall see this evening, he is a man, though still, who will call upon the name of the Lord at various different times. Another contrast is the references in chapters 14 and 15. There are at least three of them where the Spirit of the Lord comes down upon Samson. But here in chapter 16, he doesn't realize that the Spirit of the Lord had departed from him. And so in chapters 14 and 15, although he wasn't the godliest of all men, he was endued with power. And when he really needed an outpouring and a real empowering by God's Spirit, that is what happened. But now the Spirit of the Lord has really departed from him. No mention in chapter 16 of the Spirit of the Lord coming down upon Samson. In chapter 15, Samson is very dependent upon the Lord, isn't he? He cries out to the Lord, doesn't he? In dependence upon him, and the Lord sustains him. Chapter 16, he's very self-confident, isn't he? And self-sufficient, and he fails, and the Lord has departed from him. Deliberate contrast for us. The same words being used, but in a different way, causing us to really see how far Samson has fallen in his relationship and his walk and in his service of the Lord. The parallels, though, are equally startling and instructive. Notice straight away, now Samson went to Gaza and saw a harlot there. Well, chapter 14, it begins, one of the first things we see of him as an adult, isn't it, that he sees a Philistine woman. The woman, though, through persistence, again in the story, obtains his secret and betrays him. It's a weakness, isn't it, that he has, that is just clearly repeated again for us this evening. Again, Samson is bound like he was in chapter 15. He is in chapter 16. Again, the Philistines are slaughtered. And the writer wants us to see all of these things and gain the various different lessons from them. As I said, in chapter 15 and 16, he calls upon the Lord. And at the end of chapter 15, the end of chapter 16, it tells us that Samson did legitimately judge Israel for 20 years. So although we're going to go to the depths of depravity, and this is how far can you go away from the Lord without proving that you're really not the Lord's at all, still the Bible reminds us that he's in Hebrews chapter 11 as a man of faith, and we're told he legitimately was the judge of Israel for 20 years. Well, in all of these contrasts and in all of these parallels, we're going to draw out four main lessons this evening. And the first one is the tragedy of Yahweh's servant in chapter 16 and the first 21 verses. Now Samson, we are told, he goes down to Gaza and he sees a harlot. Very different from the moral family girl from Timnah. She seemed to have a father that seemed to be very close in a family home, in a kind of quite a moral situation. Well, here, this one, this girl is nothing like that. She really is, well, just plainly a prostitute. The locals are tipped off and they assemble to ambush the party boy at the city gates in the morning. They seem to be quite quiet and relaxed, and they don't think that this is going to be too much of a job. He's going to be quite exhausted by the morning, and when he comes out, we will kill him. That's their thinking, isn't it? They never consider the Spirit of the Lord again and again. They never consider the Spirit of the Lord. They don't understand. They don't grasp really who the God Samson worships is and how the Spirit of the Lord comes down upon him and empowers him. Well, while the Gaza Civil Defense Unit are outside the city gates waiting for him, possibly some elite crack team assigned to deal with Samson, code name Smash Samson or something like that, Samson comes smashing out himself, doesn't he? Suddenly at midnight, the doors, the posts, the bolts are smashed from the inside. They're carried 7 miles over to the hill facing Hebron and they are thrown over the hill, leaving now the town open to enemies and with a serious dent in the Gaza municipal budget. Well, the story focuses around Delilah, though, and that's what they really want us to see. Delilah is the only lady that is mentioned in the whole of the narrative. Samson's mother's name, not mentioned. His wife's name, at Timnah, she's not mentioned. And the harlot's name, she's not mentioned. But Delilah is mentioned at this point. She doesn't try to protest against the plans of the lords of the Philistines. She sees this as a good game and she's going to have a good time at it as well. And well, she seems to be having a whale of a time with the bowstrings and the new ropes, but probably not when her loom gets smashed by Samson. We don't know. But you can try to imagine the scene, can't you? You don't need too much of an imagination. The conversation, the banter, if you like, the psychology, the subtle mind games and the childishness of it all as they go backwards and forwards. And finally, she brings out the trump card. How can you say that you love me? And as soon as women start using language like that, you know there's going to be trouble. Well, he crumbles, doesn't he? The man who can smash through gates, the man who can pull down temples, the man who can do all kinds of imaginary things, killing thousands and the like. He just can't resist a woman when she persists in this way. And this is his weakness. And well, he finally does tell her all that is in his heart. And she knows now, she knows that he's not telling little tales or mucking around anymore, but he has been wearied down to the point, hasn't he? And he's got no strength left in him at all. And she knows that she's got him now, and so she sends to the lords of the Philistines this time, all of the games and the play and the messing around is all over, and I know that he has told us all that is in his heart. And she knows that, well, cha-ching, payday has come. Well, it reminds us, doesn't it, as we see so very sadly, we see him in verse 21 now, as we get to the end of this section. Then the Philistines took him and put out his eyes and brought him down to Gaza. They bound him with bronze fetters and he became a grinder in the prison. And that's the tragedy of it. He really is a judge. He really is somebody that makes it into the elite men and women of the faithful in Hebrews chapter 11. He really will be in heaven. He really will be rewarded in many different ways. But here is the tragedy sometimes of God's genuine believing people. That although we are delivered from the penalty of sin, although the reign and the dominion of sin in some sense has been broken so that we are free from it to walk in paths of righteousness, the pollution, the pleasure, and something of the power of sin can come upon us, can't it? And here we see a very, very clear picture of the consequences of sin in the life of the believer. Sin will always blind us, sin will always bind us, and sin will always put us to the grindstone. It blinds us, doesn't it, when we dabble around. And it wasn't that one minute he's this massively huge, strong, faithful servant of the Lord, walking in the Spirit, walking in faith, walking in godliness and everything, and then the next minute he's with a prostitute with his eyes pulled out. It goes up and down, doesn't it? Every day, a day that we predominantly obey and look to the Lord and live by faith makes it easier for us the next day to obey and walk with the Lord. But a day that is not spent in fellowship with the Lord and in obedience to Him makes it the next day harder to obey and easier to disobey. There's this constant struggle in the soul, isn't there? Like in the body. The younger ones might not know anything about this, but as soon as you get to 30, 35 or so, it is so hard to maintain your health and your strength. And there's this constant struggle, isn't there, to maintain your health and strength when you're in your 30s, 40s and onwards. Well, the soul is exactly the same thing. And constantly the Lord is saying, read my word, look to me, see who I am, see what I am like. And although our eyes have been opened to who Jesus is and what he has done if we are Christians, we look to see more, don't we? Because we could never see the wholeness and the fullness of the magnificence and the beauty and the splendor and the preciousness and the magnificence of Christ. There is always more. What never ceased to amaze me is I can spend near on a day and a half reading, studying, reading commentaries of men that have spent a whole lot longer trying to get to the bottom of a passage, preach on the same passage for the fourth or the fifth time, and then be reading the passage during the sermon and see something that nobody else and I haven't seen in all of those hours and hours of praying and looking over it. It's like an onion, isn't it? That just you take a layer off and then there's another layer and then there's another layer and there's another layer and there is another layer. And if we're walking with the Lord and we're looking to the Lord and we're being faithful to Him and we're being sincere and we're reading the Bible and praying and doing all the things that we know that we should be, our eyes are increasingly open more and more and more to all of the various attributes and works and sufficiency and supremacy and uniqueness of the Lord Jesus Christ. And our vision of the glory of God increases. Our vision of His wisdom and His will and His promises and the blessedness of heaven and the horrors of hell are increasingly enlarged in our understanding. But if we go in the other direction and we begin to disobey and there is unbelief and there is rebelliousness of heart, well, it leads to us not becoming completely blind, but we can seemingly become very, very dim in our sight and understanding and in our fellowship with the Lord. How sad it is that in verse 20, he rises up, doesn't he? And he says, oh, it's okay, he says. I will go out as before at other times and I'll shake myself free. No problem at all, he thinks. Although he has betrayed the Lord in telling a Gentile and a pagan the secret to his strength, but he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. In Hosea it says something of the same words about Israel. Strangers have devoured his strength and he knew it not. This is being written for us, yes, as individuals. Yes, this actually happened. This is a real man and a real story. But Samson is also very much a mirror reflection, isn't he, of the state of Israel. They thought they were all right. Like the Pharisees and the Sadducees in Jesus' day, they thought they were all right. But in actual fact, they didn't really realize and know that the Spirit of the Lord had departed from them. It's a parallel to Israel in many ways. As Samson, so Israel was raised up out of nothing and richly gifted by the Lord. They pander around, though, with other lovers and idols, don't they? Always expecting Yahweh's help and presence, ignorant of their own spiritual condition, assuming all that is well. And we find many times in Jeremiah and Hosea exactly the same things being said. Assuming that Yahweh was always just at their disposal whenever they felt like calling upon him, and that he would never declare Ichabod or the glory has departed from them. In today's New Testament language, as Jesus speaks to the churches through John, he says to them, I know your works, I know that you're fervent and this and that and the other, but I've got this against you, that you've left your first love. You see, Samson thought that he was going about, he's doing all the right things and everything. It's okay. I'll cry out to the Lord as I've done in other times and it's all going to be all right. But the tragedy is that he didn't know that the Lord had departed from him, and the consequences of his sin is his eyes are taken out, he is bound and put to the grindstone. Sin will always blind us. And we can have times, as believers where we draw near to God and God draw near to us. We're assured of our salvation. We're walking in fellowship with him. Oh, it seems like every day is a sunny day. Nothing can seem to move us or bring us down. But then the weeks turn to months, the months turn to years maybe. And our commitment to studying the Bible and to prayer and to church and to serving and to sacrificing our time, talents and resources diminishes and diminishes. And not in the space of an afternoon, but over the space of a few months or years even. Our vision and our grasp of the glory and the wonder, the majesty and the uniqueness of God can really, really diminish. It blinds us, doesn't it? But it also binds and ensnares and entraps us. As Hebrews chapter 12 says, seeing we're surrounded by such a cloud of witnesses and godly men, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin that so easily besets or hinders and ensnares us. You see, we're pilgrims, aren't we? We're told to run the race that is set before us. We're told, aren't we, to walk with the Lord. These are illustrations, aren't they, for us, for walking, taking a pilgrimage, going in a certain direction, walking in paths of righteousness, running the race that is set before us is scriptural language, isn't it? But what does sin do? It kind of causes us to slow down, meander a little bit maybe, stop sometimes, and even walk in the opposite and wrong direction. It blinds us and it binds, hindering and ensnaring us. Not only is this such a wonderful picture of what sin does to us because sin blinds us and sin binds us, but it puts us to the grind, doesn't it? What should he be doing? Well, in Old Testament language, he should be out smashing Philistines, shouldn't he? Bringing victory and freedom and liberty, leading the children of God into faith and courage against the enemy. But what does he end up like? Blinded, bound, and just doing the work of a donkey. It's quite amazing that people with very little talents, very little education, very little initiative, very little common sense even, can walk and live by faith and take great strides of faith and encourage others to take great strides of faith, while at other times those that have monumentous amounts of initiative, common sense, education, abilities, and this, that, and everything else are really doing nothing more than donkeys with their lives. Because they've allowed sin to come in various ways and in different ways. And now, well, this great man, Samson, who could and should be doing and continue to do great things, not just on the odd occasions, but consistently through his 20 years, he should have been completely delivering the people from the Philistines. He now finds himself blinded, bound, and put to the grindstone with hard, meaningless, futile work. He's now in the maximum security wing of Gaza State Prison in the hard labor camp. Peter tells us, doesn't he? Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against your souls. Or James tells us when lust is conceived, it brings forth sin, and when sin is finished, it brings forth death. The principle of shame, loss of assurance and confidence and fellowship with the Lord, usefulness, and not complete spiritual death. It's not that anybody can lose their salvation and lose the love of God and lose their place in God's kingdom. Not at all. But we can lose our usefulness. We can lose our joy and our peace and our sense of the love of God and our fellowship and communion with him. And we can end up pretty blind, pretty bound,
and pretty much doing the work of donkeys. It's a real tragedy, isn't it, in many senses. The tragedy of Yahweh's servant is seen here.
We move on to our second point, and these are all going to be a lot quicker, but the vindication now of Yahweh's honor. Samson is not going to remain a hairless trophy in the prison mill for the rest of his life, though, and the story starts to turn around. He wants us to see the tragedy as a warning to us that we would, well, let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall, for no temptation has overtaken you, but such is common to man, is the words of the Apostle Paul. But now he wants us to see the stupidity again of the Philistines and the vindication of Yahweh's honor. Notice that they had failed to remember that it's the hair on Samson's head that is the secret behind his strength. He was a Nazarite, wasn't he? So when he was dedicated and consecrated and set apart to the Lord, he was strong. But when that is taken away, he loses his strength. Samson now, hair is growing back and the Philistines can't see it. And you can imagine now, if you were reading this as an Israelite, you're thinking, if you don't already know the story, his hair's growing back, he's being brought out in public, oh, there's going to be another massacre of stupid Philistines. And it would have been quite entertaining to the Israelite mind. Losing all of the bureaucrats, their national leadership in one foul swoop, is what is going to happen, and an Israelite would find this more than just a little amusing. But the hilarity and the fun is the servant that should sober us up to the solemnity of what's going on. We've talked about this on a couple of occasions. There is some humor in this, and God is mocking his enemies as he will mock his enemies at the end of time. But what is happening is they're crying out, our God Dagon is so great. You see, our God Dagon is obviously better than your God Yahweh, because our God Dagon as well delivered this kind of thorn in our flesh. But it's not Dagon that has done this. They are blaspheming. It is the absence of Yahweh that has brought about the tragedy and the bad things that have happened. The narrative should anger us just a little. We see this, don't we, all over the world, paganism and false gods and everything else. But these things are recorded for us as they're boasting, as they're praising, as they're rejoicing in a false god. We should somewhat read these things and say, we want the name of Yahweh to be vindicated. And if you'd not read the whole story and you were hearing it for the first time, and if it was being read slowly to you, a good Israelite would read these things. Go, I want Yahweh's name vindicated. I don't want this to end in a tragedy and bad news at the end of the story. I want these enemies put to silence, and I want Yahweh's name to be known to be the one true and only living God. See, that's the heart of the New Testament, isn't it? Again and again. Because they see the victory of God through his servant, Jesus Christ. Well, to him be glory and praise and honor. It's again and again and again in New Testament book after New Testament book after New Testament book. And as we see this, and as we see this in our day and in our generation, multiple different gods and everything else exalted and this, that and the other, shouldn't we want Yahweh's name vindicated? Shouldn't we want people praising Jesus rather than anything and everything else? We see the tragedy of Yahweh's servant. We see the vindication of Yahweh's honor, which is coming. We see the nearness of Yahweh's help as well, don't we? Although the Spirit of the Lord has left him because he's been with harlots and he's been with Delilah and he's been doing all manner of foolish and stupid things and his own sin has brought about his blindness and being bound and put to the grindstone, we do see the nearness of Yahweh's help though. It's no minor element in the narrative, is it, when Yahweh calls upon the Lord? It's almost like you want to underline and highlight those little things because they are really important. Samson prays now for strength, for vindication, and for death. He is now willing to once again depend upon the Lord. He knows that he has gone so far down the wrong way that he can't put everything right again. But he's saying, strengthen me once more. Let me get vengeance upon them for my eyes. And Lord, I know I'm not going to get out of this alive, but let me do what I should have been doing over the last few years. He calls on the Lord who alone can hear and answer prayer. They're all praying to Dagon, aren't they? But Dagon doesn't hear the thousands that are crying out to him. There's one man who cries out to the Lord, and unlike Dagon, well, the Lord hears, and Dagon is unwilling, unable, completely incompetent to protect his worshippers. And it reminds us of the nearness of Yahweh's help. That God is the God of all grace. That though Samson previously would have rather been playing around with Delilah than nurturing and using his God-given gifts, that he's often completely forgetting his calling as a judge of Israel, blatantly disobeying one of the clear commandments, or one of the Ten Commandments with the prostitute, wasting his time, talents and resources, faithlessly bartering away his secret strength, faithless, foolish, and fallen at times, yet God hears. The believer can be cast down, but never cast off. What a message to faithless, foolish, fallen Israel. That whoever calls on the name of the Lord, they will be saved. Does not the psalmist tell us that he will hear whoever calls upon him? And even as he's in Dagon's temple, even as he's in the darkest, most pagan place in all of the world, if you like, he calls upon the Lord, and the Lord hears and answers him. That's a great lesson. It may be to one person here this evening, maybe to somebody who's going to listen to the CD, or maybe to somebody who's going to listen on the internet in 10 years' time, I don't know. They might find themselves in a really dark place where they've let God down, repeatedly let God down, after many, many warnings, and they feel blind and bound and doing nothing more than the work of a donkey in their lives. Yet even in the darkness and in the seeming despair of that condition and state, when we sincerely cry out to the Lord, he hears and he answers and he helps. We were reminded yesterday, weren't we, at our prayer meeting of the patience of God. I'm mindful so very often in times like this of the Lord Jesus hanging upon a cross. And what does he do? The first thing he cries out, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. There's no creature, is there? There's no human being. There is no person that could ever have the patience and the long-suffering and the grace like that. But there he is, blind, bound, living the life of a donkey, really, in a pagan temple. He cries out to the Lord, and the Lord hears and answers him that one final last time. We close with the life of Samson, the narrative, before we go through it and see how Samson in many ways is a type of Christ. With our final point, we've seen the tragedy of Yahweh's servant, haven't we? And we've seen the nearness of Yahweh, where we see the strangeness of Yahweh's choice. Why would God use a character like Samson? He shatters all the molds and the expectations and all conventions, doesn't he? There are a number of churches that we just prayed for who are looking for a pastor. Well, imagine if Samson tried to go through the pastoral search committee. I'm sure that his application would be rejected immediately by 99.9% of Grace Baptist churches. He's entertaining and unpredictable. He's promising and yet so tragic in so many ways. He's powerful and yet so weak in so many ways. Like a story I read in one of the commentaries I've got in the US Civil War, General Grant had been reportedly being drunk during the Battle of Shiloh. And this is
in a time where drunkenness was really frowned upon in a very Christian and a very moral setting.
At about 11 o'clock one night, President Lincoln, who was a godly man, received his friend, an A.K. McClure. He was on a mission as a spokesman for a number of the Republicans who wanted General Grant out of the army. He pressed his argument for nearly 2 hours, heaping evidence upon evidence. When finally Lincoln did speak up, he gathered himself together in his chair and declared, "I cannot spare this man. He fights." Popular opinion was against him. He had problems with the booze, a little seedy perhaps, but he knew and he could fight.
This is Samson, isn't it? He knew who his enemy was in the midst of all of his failure and the tragedy of it all. Unlike the vast majority of Israelites at the time, he knew who the enemy was. He knew the Philistines were for fighting and not for submitting to. He never rolled over with the status quo, and he makes it into the Hall of Fame in Hebrews 11.
We've got our Daniels and our Marys, our Josephs and our Pauls, who seem to be squeaky clean, and it's very hard to find any fault in them at all. But the Bible also is full of men like Samson, like Abraham, like David, like Solomon, like Jonah, and like Peter. The truth is, as Paul puts it, "You see your calling, brethren, that there's not many wise men among you according to the flesh. There's not many mighty, there's not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of this world to confound the wise. God has chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things that are mighty. The base things of the world, the things which are despised, God has chosen. Yet the things which are not, to bring to nothing the things that are, so that no flesh will glory in his presence." It's a strange choice. You would have thought, surely there's somebody else who could have done a better job than Samson. Well, quite possibly there might have been. But Samson was a man who knew how to fight. And it reminds us that, well, we need to be strong and courageous against our enemy, don't we? We need to avoid the very real tragedies that Samson fell into. We need to seek the glory of God and, well, constantly be thinking glory, praise and blessing to God and to God alone. And I want everything and everyone all around me to worship and praise him as well. We need to never forget that wherever we are spiritually, the Lord is always near. And that the Lord is no respecter of persons, and he calls us to usefulness. We may have our quirkiness, we may have our failures, we may have our inconsistencies and our insincerities and all this, that and the other. Was it not the Apostle Paul at the end of his life? He said, "This is a faithful saying worthy of all acceptance, that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am chief." But Samson reminds us, in all the weaknesses and in all of the frailties, if we just rise up to serve the Lord faithfully and zealously, he is able. He is able to use the most unlikeliest of people. Admittedly, he is on occasion the most unlikeliest vessel to be used by the Lord. And yet the general principle is that holiness with zeal leads to usefulness. Nonetheless, even with all of our weakness, even if we've been absolutely trashed and dragged through the mud for decades by the devil, well, the Lord can restore the years that the locust has stripped away. And we see this in Samson, that there is always hope, isn't there? Always hope, no matter how bad we have been, for how long we have been that bad. We can always call on the name of the Lord, and he will always hear and answer in our lives. Well, what a narrative about Samson, and we'll turn back and go through the whole thing again, seeing that in many, many ways, the whole narrative points us to Christ in many ways. But we'll leave it there.